Good day. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, September 23rd, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The KUAF website giveaway is offering a pair of season tickets to the 2013 Walton Arts Center 10x10 Art Series. One winner will receive a pair of tickets to each of the 10 shows. Performances include Onda Union, Los Angeles Guitar Quartet, Chucho Valdez, and more. The drawing will be held this Friday, September 27th, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration and more information available at our website, KUAF.com. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, how the history of Arkansas was written. We speak with two of the four authors of Arkansas, A Narrative History. The book covers the formation of the Ozark Mountains to Governor Mike Beebe. Plus, our regular installment of Arkansas, and Becca Martin Brown tells us what's up. But first, the final details and construction approvals are coming together for the Big River Steel Project in East Arkansas. Roby Brock of Arkansas Talk Business spoke last week with John Corinti, lead developer and investor of the billion-dollar super project.
Well, basically what happened on Thursday is the Department of Environmental Quality approved an air permit for the $1.1 billion Big River Steel super project up in Osceola. That is the last real big hurdle that needed to be okayed in terms of regulation and state authority to build that big project. Now everything turns its attention to the financing, which will be privately funded for the most part from a variety of different European and national banks. And with this air permit in hand now, the project's got a green light to go.
Construction is expected to begin in late November of this year and take about 20 months to complete. Central Arkansas Water says it may file a lawsuit against ExxonMobil, as well as the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. The utility company has requested safety information since April, signed a confidentiality agreement in late August, and has yet to receive access to the information about the Pegasus pipeline, which ruptured in March. The pipeline runs through the Lake Maumelle watershed, which is the region's source of drinking water. John Tynan, with Central Arkansas Water, says they want to work with ExxonMobil, but said Friday a lawsuit will be filed if they don't get the information.
Exxon has constantly claimed that the information that we've requested is not subject to disclosure because of either security or proprietary related issues. And CAW has been diligently working with Exxon to try and address their concerns, but at the same time fulfill our obligation to get that information and figure out a path forward for protecting the watershed before this pipeline restarts.
ExxonMobil has insisted the pipeline won't be restarted until it can be done so safely. A series of community meetings in Washington County will begin tomorrow. The meetings will be hosted by the Beaver Watershed Alliance. John Pennington, director of the Alliance, says the meetings are being held in the West Fork watershed of the White River.
The goal of these meetings is to get the watershed residents, landowners, and decision makers engaged in understanding more about the West Fork watershed, why it is currently listed as impaired for its entire reach, and what actions might be able to be put into place to help the river recover.
Pennington says changes in land use over the past several years, notably the introduction of Interstate 540 into the watershed, have created issues with increased runoff and sedimentation in the West Fork watershed. He says the West Fork of the White River has been listed as an impaired waterway for quite some time.
You know, this isn't anything new, but what is new is that there is an organization that's wanting to work with the landowners to further investigate the causes of the impairment, but also potential solutions. And so really that's why we're carrying out these meetings, is to combine the scientific research that exists with the local input from people that live in the watershed and might have some understandings that have never been captured in a scientific document.
In addition, Pennington says the meetings will also serve as an opportunity to communicate the water quality issues to local stakeholders and to offer best management practices that could positively impact water quality in the West Fork watershed. The first meeting will take place tomorrow evening from 6 to 8 at the Greenland Community Center. For a full schedule of meetings in the West Fork watershed, visit our website, ozarksatlarge.com. September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month across the nation. And though the month is nearly over, Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe reminded Arkansans in his weekly radio address that mental health disorders can affect persons of any age, race, religion, or income, and that suicide is the 10th highest cause of all deaths in the United States.
It is estimated that nearly 5 million Americans have lost a loved one to suicide. In Arkansas alone, 400 suicides took place last year, ranking the state 15th nationwide. It's important to know which groups of people are at most risk. While the suicide rate remains highest for adults 75 years of age and older, our veterans are also at an increased risk, and the suicide rate for those aged 15 to 24 has more than doubled since the 1950s. In fact, among Arkansans ages 15 to 24, suicide is the second leading cause of death.
Governor Beebe says earlier this year, 37 state agencies, organizations, foundations, and professionals jointly formed the statewide suicide prevention initiative, and that in 2010, his office, in conjunction with the State Attorney General's Office, the Arkansas National Guard, the Arkansas Crisis Center, and the Division of Behavioral Health, founded the Arkansas Suicide Prevention Network. Work has begun on replacement of a drainage structure at the Locust Avenue and 9th Street intersection in Fayetteville. The construction will improve storm drainage capacity in association with the city's Frisco Trail Southern Extension to Walker Park. Through the duration of the project, which is expected to wrap up on October 18th, the intersection will be closed to through traffic, though access to adjacent residences and businesses will be maintained. The Community Blood Center of the Ozarks is holding two blood drives this week in Fayetteville. Tomorrow, the Washington County Courthouse will host a blood drive between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. And on Wednesday, the drive will be held from 9 a.m. to noon on the downtown Fayetteville Square. Recent rain has curbed wildfires in some parts of Arkansas, but agricultural experts say those showers will do little to improve conditions in areas suffering from extreme drought conditions. Dr. John Berry is a forester and volunteer firefighter in southwestern Arkansas. As a specialist with the University of Arkansas Division of Agriculture, Berry says hay fires in some pastures can be difficult to extinguish, and some hay bales can spontaneously combust.
There are two types of problems that we see with hay bales. One is when they're not properly dried before they're stored in the barn. If they're stacked in the barn before they're properly dried, then they start generating their own heat and can generate enough heat to set themselves on fire in the barn. The other issue is when a farmer is baling hay and something starts a fire in the hay field, and as it burns across the field, it will set the bales of hay on fire.
Last week, a load of hay caught fire while being hauled on a trailer along Highway 71 in Scott County. But Berry says fires usually start in a hay field when a baler hits a rock and creates a spark. Mechanical problems with a baler can also set a hay bale on fire while it's in the machine, and that blaze can then spread once the bale comes in contact with loose hay on the ground. The Washington County Sheriff's Office announced this morning that the red flag fire warning issued on September 10th has been lifted. According to the National Weather Service, the monitoring station at Drake Field has observed more than 2.8 inches of rainfall since the red flag warning was issued, but the area is still a few inches below the average year-to-date precipitation totals. Forecast this evening calls for partly cloudy skies with overnight lows from 52 in northwest Arkansas to 58 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, your Tuesday, mostly sunny with highs from 78 to 83. And tomorrow evening, mostly clear with lows from 52 to 58. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas. Moving two steps forward, one step back, Roby Brock from our content partner, TalkBusiness.net, takes a look at the state of the economy in this week's Talk Business.
The latest Federal Reserve Burgundy Book, which provides a snapshot of Arkansas's economy in the second quarter, highlights more evidence of a two steps forward, one step backward recovery. The report provides statistical and anecdotal notes on 62 of the state's 75 counties. The report noted that housing activity strengthened throughout the region. It also said that manufacturing employment declined modestly from the second quarter of 2012, but service sector jobs from Fayetteville to Fort Smith and trade and transportation jobs in central Arkansas were, quote, especially brisk. Arkansas Insurance Commissioner Jay Bradford told legislators and the media that the plan rates for insurance policies on the state's forthcoming health insurance exchange will be released this week. Known as the Health Insurance Marketplace, the exchange will operate with four insurance carriers providing a range of plans, gold, silver, and bronze, that will offer varying benefits. Potential enrollees could qualify for subsidies or tax credits depending on income levels. The plan prices may also vary depending on an individual's age. The Health Insurance Marketplace is scheduled to begin operations on October 1st. Windstream CEO Jeff Gardner is optimistic that Congress can become functional, pass meaningful tax reform, and help boost a struggling economy despite new data that suggests his peers see conditions declining. On Wednesday, Gardner attended the Business Roundtable, an elite group of about 200 U.S. CEOs, for a conversation with President Barack Obama in Washington. Those issues discussed include raising the debt limit, tackling the deficit, and meaningful corporate tax reform. A new report from the roundtable showed declining confidence among CEOs regarding sales and capital spending. The head of the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Richard Cordray, met with about 15 state bankers in Arkansas to discuss concerns related to the Dodd-Frank financial law. According to several bankers in attendance, the meeting was well received, but apprehension remains. The meeting was co-hosted by House Speaker Davy Carter, who is a banker, and Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel, who solicited Cordray to venture to the state to hear bankers' concerns on the rules and regulations impacting community banks. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is an outgrowth of the Dodd-Frank law, which was passed at the urging of the president in response to the near collapse of several large U.S.-based banking operations in 2007 and 2008. Community banks have complained that many of the regulations aimed at those larger national banks are negatively affecting local business. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Support for TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the United States. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from four offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, comparing the new sitcom The Goldbergs to another show called The Goldbergs from decades ago.
Jeff Garlin, who plays the father, says, you know, by calling the show The Goldbergs, you might as well call it The Jews.
How TV portrays Jews then and now. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock here on KUAF 91.3 FM. In just over 13 minutes on Ozarks at Large, we speak with two authors of a narrative history on Arkansas. But first, a look at the Indian meal moth. My kitchen was recently overrun by the common grain-eating household pest. I invited our insect expert, Dr. Donald Steinkraus, to learn more. Dr. Steinkraus started the conversation by asking me a question.
How did you first notice the infestation?
Well, there were a lot of moths flying around in my kitchen, and I really sort of just attributed it to living out in the country.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of insects just come into the house when you open your doors or crawl underneath the sills and things. I always find things in my house.
Well, and then I started noticing kind of spider webbish type things on like a bag of chips.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then finally, I found I had purchased at a local store a bulk trail mix.
Uh-huh.
And this bag of bulk trail mix was pretty nasty.
Yeah, that's so how'd you find out they were meal moths?
Well, I actually posted on Facebook and said, I have tons of moths in my kitchen. What's going on here? And people then commented. Facebook can be a great resource sometimes.
It definitely.
Yeah, and found out that they were meal moths.
So what'd they tell you to do?
To just get rid of everything, pretty much.
That's a little extreme, perhaps, but that's basically the principle of getting rid of them. So you were successful in doing so?
Yes. I mean, it's been about 2 weeks or so now. I got rid of everything.
All your, like, wheat products and grain products and dried fruits and things like that.
Pretty much anything dried that was not in a can in my cabinet.
Yeah, that's a good strategy. Yeah, this is a little moth, which is very common. I've had it in my kitchen, too. And same thing, I've noticed lots of the little moths flying around. And then you find the infestation where it came from. In your case, trail mix, bulk trail mix, which is probably a good source of them. The one I had once, I had a lot of trouble finding it. I used to keep my cereal boxes on top of my refrigerator, and one of my cereal boxes had fallen behind the refrigerator, which I didn't know, and sat there for months and months and months and produced many, many of these moths and larvae. So sometimes you have to really go searching to find out where did you spill something or where is your product hidden.
So were they already in the trail mix when I purchased it?
That would be my guess, yeah, especially with bulk trail mix. And any grain product which is lying around for a long time, especially if it's open, like this one was like in an open bin or something, well, the moths can get in and lay their eggs. And if it sits there for quite a while, it takes about a month for them to go through the life cycle from egg to adult. And so, yeah, I think bulk products are definitely a possible source. They can live in the nooks and crannies. And that's something, I don't know if you did that. Did you try to clean your cupboards carefully and get all the little debris in the nooks and crannies out?
I did. I did a number on my kitchen. I got rid of the shelf liner and then used Clorox wipes, on all the shelves.
Yeah. Did you vacuum?
I did.
Yeah. In my opinion, a vacuum cleaner is one of the best pest control tools there is. People will tell me they have something in their house and they want to call a pest control company, which might spray or something, but often you can just vacuum up some of the insects. But certainly you can vacuum up all the spilled flour and cake mix and trail mix and stuff that might be around. Yeah, the critical thing, from what I understand about these Indian meal moths, is that after you've cleaned out your infestation, you want to make sure that everything you bring back into the house for several weeks or months afterwards is in a closely sealed good container, because the larvae, the caterpillars of these little moths, find nooks and crannies around the house to pupate in. And then the moths will come out. And so if you go back to the old style, just having loose product around, the new moths will come out and reinfest your house. But once they've come out, apparently the moths only live about 1 week. And they don't feed or anything. So once all of the moths have emerged from the larvae hidden around your house, then you should be pretty safe for a while, unless you bring in more contaminated, infested product of some sort. Apparently, the caterpillars can crawl through plastic bags.
Oh, yeah.
And thin boxes. So, it's important probably just not have something sit there for years and, cycle your food through. But yeah, the refrigerator is a very good place to keep stuff. Yeah.
Yes, I had an unopened bag of rice that I thought I could save. Uh-huh. And a few days later went to go make the rice. Mm-hmm. And there was definitely, I would call it a maggot, but evidently it's a caterpillar.
I brought some with me.
I found it and it blended in with the rice, but I did see it. Luckily, I went through, I really looked at the rice.
Yeah, so. they do actually, to the naked eye, they look a lot like a maggot because they're cream colored. They're almost exactly the size of like a housefly or a blowfly maggot. And but if you looked at them closely, you'd see that they have a distinct head with true legs and are a caterpillar. They're just little cream colored caterpillars. But they're only about a half inch long and an eighth of an inch in width. And like any moth, they have a really great ability to reproduce. One female moth might be able to lay 200 eggs. And then if each of those survives in a month, you've got like thousands of moths. And so that's definitely one of the problems with insect infestations. They can grow very rapidly.
It makes me feel better to know that they're not maggots, though.
I brought in an adult also to show you. So they're quite small, about a half inch long, too, and sort of a grayish moth.
Light brownish, yeah.
Yeah. the best thing for most of these household pests is sort of sanitation, trying to keep your house as clean as possible, you know, within limits, as clean as possible, and not have spilled things around and leave them there. And
keep everything in an airtight container.
That definitely would help. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they don't carry diseases that I know of, and they're not going to bite you or harm you otherwise.
All right. Yeah. Well, you brought in a kind of an aquarium-like mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. What do you have here?
We were talking a little bit about household pests. This is one which really is a much more serious pest. This is the American cockroach, Paraplanita americana. And this one, along with about three or four other species of cockroaches, like to live with humans. They're philosophically, I think something kind of interesting. Like, it definitely seems like the things that like to live with us aren't very pleasant. You know what I mean? It's like, but not like butterflies. It's mm-hmm. like, of course, a Plodia is a moth. But these things, you can see they're very flat. And do you see some of them in there?
I do, very long antennae.
Yeah, they're very, very flat, and they can get into small cracks in the house. And if you also notice in here, the whole container is spotted with their fecal material. So these are really a kind of a dirty insect, and they smell quite bad. They're hard to eradicate once they really get going in a house. For the same reason Plodia or the meal moth is that they're small. It doesn't take very much food to make a nice meal. So you drop one crumb on the floor, and then at night a cockroach can eat that crumb, and that's a pretty good meal for that cockroach. So these things are quite serious pests in homes, and they don't generally vector or carry human pathogens, but they are a very allergic animal. Like they put out allergens, which can cause really bad reactions in people if they're numerous. And they really do smell bad.
Even just, yeah, like you said, their fecal matter. I mean, I can imagine having that in your house.
Right. Well, because when you're in bed at night and you have a cockroach infestation in your house, they're all out on all your counters, eating any crumbs you left and defecating. And they're just, and then they go back in their cracks under the sink or wherever they're hiding, and you don't see them that much in the daytime. They're easy to pick up, too. Have you ever had a cockroach infestation?
I have seen them at my house before. Uh-huh. Does that mean I have an infestation?
Probably not.
Okay.
Well, there's also a lot of wild cockroaches that are not ones which come and live in our house. Like, you'll often find cockroaches called wood roaches and things, which, same thing, will come to lights and they'll come into your house, but they're not able to live in your house. There's actually about 4,000 species of cockroaches in the world, and only about, 5 to 10 are ones which want to live with humans. So probably the ones you saw are just wild roaches.
Well, and the ones that I've seen in my house before, again, it's been a long time, but they don't look like the ones that you have here.
Yeah, they're probably with wood roaches. They're slightly darker, a little
yes.
smaller maybe.
Yes, much smaller and, not that color, because those are kind of a almost reddish brown.
Yeah, definitely. They are a reddish brown.
Yeah.
They're very fast, too. These guys can move. If I took them out of this cage, they could probably escape us. They can really run and get under things. And so it's easy to get an infestation of these things. These are almost impossible to be clean enough to keep them out just by cleanliness, because it takes so little to feed them.
So if you see a roach in your house, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're dirty or...
No,
I
don't think so. Not at all. Even an infestation, if one gets going, before you know it, you could have quite a few. So then you have to do things like, try to really super clean up and find out where they're getting and close up their cracks so they can't get in and out, and put out sticky boards. And there's cockroach bait traps and things that you can buy. I'm really not, as a person, I'm not in favor of using chemical pesticides in your home a lot. And it seems like that's true for the Indian meal moth. Most people say, cleanliness will get you a long ways, and freezing things. And
well, I did get, I got them at the local natural food store, but they're just pantry pest. They look like a cardboard tent, and when they fly in, they can get stuck.
The pheromone baited traps. Almost all of those things have the female sex pheromone, and they capture the male. The male smells this and thinks, oh, there's a female in there, and he goes in and they have this sticky tack trap stuff
right.
in there, and then they get stuck to it. What people say is that those are really good for monitoring whether you have something. But they won't control an Indian meal moth thing. I mean, you couldn't leave all of your trail mix, your infested trail mix, and put those traps up and control your infestation.
But was it okay for, I got like, I mean, I have like 8 of them.
Wow. You catch any moths in it?
Oh, tons of them.
Still?
Tons of them. Well, it's probably time to throw them away, but.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they might be good because they like I say, as a monitoring tool, if like you threw away those ones and you put up a new trap, you would see whether you still have moths flying in the house. And if you still have moths flying, then it either means you still have an infestation or there's moths coming out of the pupae that are hidden in the cracks and crevices. And so it means you still have to be really vigilant. But once you, if you put one up and then you don't catch any moths for months, you could probably say, well, I can probably relax a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I think having good jars for your grains and beans and dried fruits is a good idea. Or refrigeration is a good idea.
I need to do that. I need to invest in some new airtight containers.
Yeah.
For sure.
Sounds like you did exactly the right thing, though.
Okay, good.
Me.
Good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anything else?
The only thing I brought in is a cicada today.
Yeah.
You know, the cicadas are still singing in the trees mm-hmm. like crazy, but more and more as I walk around, I find them dead on the sidewalks.
I've seen a few.
They're just worn out, dying of old age. You know, the males have sung.
It's trying that to, time of year.
Yeah. It's just like, but I like to notice them. I sort of think, you know, most people don't notice that these things are falling out of the trees, but they're sort of just like us. They live their
here.
Life and they wear themselves out and then they go.
Yep. Falls here.
Yep, it is.
I've noticed a few. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Steinkraus.
You're welcome.
Dr. Donald Steinkraus is our Ozarks at Large insect expert. He's also an entomologist at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. This is Ozarks at Large. Imagine trying to tell the story of Arkansas in just under 500 pages. Four authors do just that in the just-published second edition of Arkansas, A Narrative History, published by the University of Arkansas Press. Jeannie Wayne, Thomas DeBlack, George Sabo, and Morris Arnold examine almost everything that has formed the people and the history of the state. This month, two of the authors, Jeannie Wayne and George Sabo, came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to discuss the book with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums. She is a professor of history at the University of Arkansas, and he is the director of the Arkansas Archaeological Survey and professor of anthropology at the U of A. Kyle asked them how they managed to go from Pangaea on page 3 to Mike Beebe on page 463 and get everything important in between.
Well, when you pick yourself up off the floor from contemplating the process of writing a book like this, you begin to compartmentalize. And most of us have been, you know, we lecture. We already have had to make the decision about what goes in and what doesn't go into a lecture covering a chronological period of time. So we are accustomed, at least to some extent, to doing that. Now, having said that, we're also accustomed to assigning our students readings from all the stuff that we're not going to cover in class. So it is daunting. And I think all historians, and I guess anthropologists too, make decisions based on what they, A, think really absolutely has to be in there, and two, or B, what they're most interested in, you know, what they privilege as it most important. We all have point of view. Economic historians are going to privilege the economic. Political historians are going to privilege the political, et cetera. So and that's one thing. George?
Well, I think also because it is a narrative, a story, on top of compartmentalizing or picking the events that we want to emphasize, we're attentive to drawing the links between mm-hmm. the events that gives us the large story, that gives us the narrative in the round that goes from Pangaea to fracking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. One of the joys of working in a collaboration with George and Buzz Arnold and Thomas DeBlack is that we were all congenial to work with and respectful of each other's points of view, even when at times we didn't fully agree over certain interpretations.
And I should point out that while it is a narrative history, it's still history in that when whoever wrote a chapter wasn't sure of what happened, mm-hmm. take Archibald Yell's death.
Right.
Did he charge into enemy lines or did his horse panic and take him there by accident? You let the reader know that history is not sure.
Oh, yes. Yes. I think that sometimes students find that unsettling. They just want to know what the right answer is. But I think history, students also become engaged when they understand that it's not fixed, that they can make an argument. They can go find evidence. And I guess anthropologists and archaeologists would be the same.
Well, even more so. And I think some of these mysteries add to the allure, add to the interest that people have. And so rather than trying to mask them, I think bringing them out into the open is what does attract a lot of interest to the subject matter. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I find it fascinating that we don't know and probably never will know just who the first Europeans in what would become Arkansas met with, which native people they met with, because they're
That's
called
true.
Different things by different people over a couple of centuries. So we don't know.
No, we don't. Mm-hmm. And we've been working on that problem for a century, and my guess is that we'll work on it for another century.
And still not know.
Well, I hope we'll eventually get a handle on that, but it's open-ended at this point.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine one of the biggest fears putting together something that is called a narrative history is, what are we leaving out?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I just had Patrick Williams, my colleague in the history department. In this edition, I trimmed several sections of the book out, and it turns out I trimmed one of his favorite stories out, and that is when George Hunter on the Dunbar Hunter expedition nearly shot his own hand off. And Patrick was just astonished that I would leave that out. And I said, well, Patrick, that's something you can now use in your lecture. you can take ownership of that.
Well, is that a challenge? I mean, an anecdotal great story versus we've got to get facts in, and when you update an edition, there's more that's happened.
It's true. I did have we had readers make suggestions on the second edition, and they suggested that I cut that. They didn't say how I should cut the Dunbar Hunter, but they suggested I cut it, and that I add something on the Adams-Onis Treaty. And so I guess that George Hunter shooting his hand off lost out to the Adams-Onis Treaty. Thank you very much. in case you wanted to know.
Some of the suggestions from our readers are small, but then others are larger. Mm-hmm. One of the suggestions was that we add a new chapter, one that didn't exist before, on the natural environment, on the backdrop against which all of this history develops. It's true, as we all know, that tremendous changes have been brought to the environment from the time of the very earliest settlers. Swamps have been drained, fields have been cleared for agriculture, forests have been cleared, forests have been planted, cities and towns have been built, infrastructures have been developed, but there's a common substrate that underlies all of the different groups of people, the different cultures, the different civilizations that made their home in Arkansas. And it's fascinating to delve into the question of how these different groups perceived that environment and what different perceptions were accorded to the same environmental substrate. So the Indians would interact with the environment as if it had a profound spiritual quality. Their economy was as religious as it was technical. And the same is true for some of the early European settlers. But later people saw the environment as a resource, something to be put to use in support of human endeavors. So we have these very, very different outlooks, these different perspectives on the environment, and adding that chapter gives us an opportunity to raise those questions and put forth some of that information.
It's all about, not all, but a lot of it is about perception, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
History
so.
Belongs
absolutely.
To those of us that perceive it a certain way.
Right, and those of us who write it, actually.
Yeah. Well, yes.
If you want to be in control of the minutes being taken at a meeting, take the minutes. If you want to be in control of the story, write the story.
Right, for better or ill, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I want to read a paragraph from page 142. This is from the chapter, The Rights and Rank to Which We Are Entitled. Uh-huh. The effort to establish a viable school system was further hampered by what one state official described as the indifference that pervades the public mind on the subject of education. As a result, no viable system of public education was established, and no public university was founded in the state before the Civil War. I bet you hate when lay people draw these links back, but say, wow, could, because we rank so low in so many educational
indices
mm-hmm. and have for so long. Mm-hmm. Is it fair to point back to something that long ago?
Absolutely. And I think Arkansas is not very different from, in fact, not different at all from some of our southern neighbors, Mississippi, even Tennessee to some extent, Alabama, Georgia. Obviously, North Carolina and Virginia did a lot better job of their public education, particularly their higher education. But southern states generally, given a certain southern ethos and perspective on state involvement and funding of anything, anything public, whether it's public education or public transportation, southern states before the Civil War and even for some time after the Civil War loathed to spend money on such public expenditures. Before the war, it was philosophical and economic, and after the war, it was continued to be philosophical and economic in another sense, in that we were so devastated by the Civil War, it took a while for us to pick ourselves back up off the ground and get going again. But we resisted it, and when we embraced the progressive era in the early 19th century, we went about as far as we could go, and even maybe a little further than we could afford to go. But our tax basis was so low. Our wealth basis was so low. I mean, it was very difficult to us fund even the most basic human services.
Which, for you, is more comfortable dealing with? Something that might have happened 200 years ago when you're very limited in what written actual history you have, or something that's much more recent where you have a lot more information, but you still don't have the hindsight yet to know how it's affected mm-hmm. fully. Yeah. A generation after it.
Yeah, they both have their problems. The lack of detail. Sometimes you'd like to transport yourself back 200 years with proper vaccinations for whatever diseases you might encounter, but and interview some people just to find out what the heck really did happen. But doing more recent history, I find is it's not only problematic; it's sometimes terrifying. I mean, you. People are still alive, you know, that might have a stake in the story you're telling.
Little Rock Central.
I interviewed Governor Beebe, I guess, two times on two issues, and found him to be an excellent interviewer. It was on the issue of school funding and the Little Rock desegregation suits. I had read a good deal about them, articles, books, newspaper articles, a couple of fine dissertations, and still had questions. And he had come into the legislature in 1982, right when the first school funding suit hit, and played a role in that, and then played a role in it in a later school funding suit as attorney general, and then as governor, and the same with the desegregation suit. So there is an advantage having someone who was intimately involved in two crucial issues, and who was very smart. He's a very smart guy, and he was able to, off the top of his head, give me a two long interviews worth of information that I could not find fault with. Now, there's some issues of interpretation here and there, but
you
in terms
can have
of
that with almost any subject,
yes,
right?
But in terms of the facts, he was dead on. It was beautifully done. Now, you can't do that you can't go back and interview one of the fellows that had a duel in 1827 or something and find out exactly what were you mad about. You can't do that.
Do you ever allow yourself to think, okay, when Arkansas Narrative History 5th edition comes out in 2113, what is still in and what might not be?
Oh, golly. Oh, well, it's what an interesting idea. I hadn't thought about that. I had thought about the next edition, in which case I think I'm not going to be a part of it anymore. I hope to be retired by then. But I thought that far, but I haven't thought 100 years ahead. That's an interesting idea.
I ask that because when you were talking about the, you know, the Lakeview and the school desegregation case and mm-hmm. how that, you know, that has been a very big part of Arkansas for the last uh-huh. 20 mm-hmm. years, mm-hmm. legislatively and educationally. And you wonder, will that 80, 90 years from now, will it be a paragraph in the book? I mean, there's no way to know, of course.
There isn't. I mean, the interesting part of that question is, will we still be facing some of the same kinds of questions in some new form? There's, in some ways, well, for example, I didn't go into the voter ID laws, and that was sort of on the horizon at the time we put this book into press. But one interpretation of the current attempts to essentially restrict voting, it's comparable to disfranchisement of African Americans and poor whites in the late 19th century. There's nothing essentially different about that. It's all about limiting the franchise, however you want to construe it. It's very similar to the limitations on new immigrants to the cities, and mostly northern cities, obviously, because we didn't get that many immigrants into southern cities, although there were attempts there in southern cities. Disfranchisement in the late 19th century was aimed at cities, at southern cities, mostly, and segregation particularly. So anyway, I think some of these issues don't really go away. They just transmute into something mm-hmm. else. And but if you look very closely at them, you can see the antecedents. And I think that's an important thing for us to understand as human beings, how we keep doing the same things.
Yes.
We're not shooting each other on the floor of the state legislature anymore, thank goodness. But we are still doing a lot of the same things.
I think the archaeological chapters of the 2113 book are going to be quite remarkably different because every generation of archaeologists has an arsenal, a toolkit of approaches and technologies that the previous generation did not have access to. And so if you were writing archaeology in the 1950s, let's say up to that point, you had to guess how old things were because radiocarbon dating hadn't been invented. Mm. So now we take it as a commonplace that we can measure time quite precisely. But more recently, we've developed techniques that enable us to make fairly precise statements about how certain kinds of things were used because they have microscopic wear traces on them that, again, we weren't able to detect maybe until the 1970s, but then from that point on, we've been able to work with that. We have technologies now that allow us to peer beneath the ground and see things on a wider scale.
Without disturbing the ground at all.
Without disturbing the ground, then small-scale excavations permit. So I think it's going to be a different story for the archaeologists. Mm-hmm. They'll have a lot more to say, and I think they'll be able to tell the story in a lot better way than we're able to now.
Well, thank you both very much for your time.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jeannie Wayne and George Sabo are two of the four authors of Arkansas, A Narrative History, second edition, published by the University of Arkansas Press. They talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums earlier this month. The other authors are Thomas DeBlack and Morris Arnold. Support for KUAF comes from Serta Pro Painters, serving residential and commercial clients with interior and exterior painting and interior design, deck and fence staining, and specialty finishes. Locally owned and operated by Aaron Lewis. Estimates and information available by calling 1-800-GO-CERTA or certapro.com. Walton Arts Center presents Onda Union Friday, October 4th, as part of the 10x10 Art Series. These musicians will travel across the globe to perform traditional folk music from Inner Mongolia, including throat singing and unusual instruments. Tickets and more information available at waltonartscenter.org or by calling 443-5600.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Not much is known about the life of blues performer Alec Rice Miller, better known as Sonny Boy Williamson II. Even in old age, he offered several birth dates. In the mid-1960s, when he finally became a popular musician worldwide, he was known for onstage dancing, playing harmonica with no hands or with his nose. His known recordings are from the last 14 years of his life and are considered classics of the genre. But Williamson's legacy may be as a writer. His songs have been interpreted by an incredible array of artists in and outside of the blues. 3 decades later, the Blues Brothers covered one of Williamson's earliest known recordings from the early 1950s from Jackson, Mississippi's Trumpet label, heard at the opening and called From the Bottom. Years before Sonny Boy Williamson became a recording star, he'd been a radio star in the 1940s. He could be heard on KFFA in Helena's groundbreaking King Biscuit Time program and promoting Had a Call Cough Syrup on West Memphis, Arkansas's KWEM. By the early 1960s, only about 2 years before his death, the Phillips County resident had become an international star by headlining package tours in Europe. Williams was so well-liked overseas, he extended his stay to play more festival and club dates, and he even began wearing English suits and bowler hats to complement his briefcase of harmonicas. Williamson also recorded with blues-influenced Britons like Jimmy Page and Eric Clapton and the Yardbirds. He's heard here with Eric Burdon and the Animals from a December 1963 concert. Through the decade, these emerging British rock bands would help repopularize interest in the blues, and Sonny Boy's songs would remain in the public ears as well.
I got to find out what's going down. Checking up on my baby. And you know that poor boy got to find out what's going down. So many nights and days, people. City blues happen in my town.
Williamson could be known to throw together sloppy blues verses even in the studio, but his best song titles could read like poetry: Fattening Frogs for Snakes, Eyesight to the Blind, Your Funeral in My Trial. Besides, by the time he had recorded for Chess, he was likely in his late 60s at the least. Williamson had played with Robert Johnson and Phillips County native Robert Nighthawk in the 1930s. He'd given a young Howlin' Wolf harmonica lessons, and now Wolf recorded on Chess as well. One might expect songs written by an influential blues harmonica player to endure among blues interpreters like Taj Mahal. He's heard here from 1968, doing Sonny Boy Williamson's Checkin' Up on My Baby from the Rolling Stones movie Rock and Roll Circus. Aerosmith, Can't Eat, and Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac have covered Sonny Boy Williamson's songs. So did the Moody Blues. Eric Clapton did a version of Eyesight to the Blind for Tommy, The Who's movie about a deaf, dumb, and blind boy, and The Who cut its own version, too. It's the only cover song found in The Who's rock opera.
You talk about your woman. I wish you could see mine. Yeah, you talk about your woman. I wish you could see mine. Every time she starts to love and she brings eyesight to the blind.
Williamson's songs have often transcended the genre in which they were written. Of course, blues revival acts like Canned Heat and Fleetwood Mac covered them, but so did R&B's Solomon Burke and the New York Dolls. Mose Allison did Williamson with a jazz flair in the 1950s and 60s, while Bob Dylan stole the line Nine Below Zero. Led Zeppelin stole Sonny Boy Williamson's Bring It On Home, but Willie Dixon wrote that one. In 1992, Bruce Springsteen added lyrics and interpreted Williamson's Cross My Heart as a pop song on Springsteen's first album after the breakup of the E Street Band.
First time I crossed my heart, I was begging, baby, please. At your bedside, down on my knees when I crossed my heart. It's when I crossed my heart. I crossed my heart, pretty baby.
When Williamson returned to the U.S. just weeks before his death, some of his friends in Arkansas and Mississippi reportedly didn't believe he had ever been in Europe, much less that he'd been in the toast of the town wherever he went. After playing across the globe, Williamson came home to die, an event he had predicted. He was right. After several weeks of making the rounds, visiting old friends, and fishing, Williamson died in Helena on May 25, 1965. Williamson's recordings and his songs continue to influence popular music today and are listened to worldwide. Here's one of the earlier attempts at interpretation of a song by Arkansas-er Sonny Boy Williamson of Helena. It's Mose Allison, recorded in 1959, covering Eyesight to the Blind.
You're talking about your woman, I wish you could see mine. You're talking about your woman, I wish you could see mine. Every time I start loving, she bring eyesight to the blind. I know her daddy got some money, I can tell by the way she walk. I know her daddy got some money, I can tell by the way she walk. Every time she started shaking, them don't begin to talk. She was lying on the bed, man next door was dying, raised up his head and said, ain't she pretty, don't you know she fine. One look at that woman bring eyesight to the blind. I declare she pretty and the whole state knows she fine. I declare she pretty and the whole state knows she fine. Every time she start loving, she bring eyesight to the blind.
From 1959, Mose Allison's version of Eyesight to the Blind, written by Alec Rice Miller, or Sonny Boy Williamson II of Helena. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
It is Monday, September 23rd, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas. This is Ozarks at Large. And joining me now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is one of those make stuff up segments.
Okay.
Because we're going to talk about a band called Vampire Weekend.
I'm familiar.
And we've established that I know nothing about music. Okay. So I'm going to quote the What's Up assistant editor, Kevin Kinder, and say that this has been a very successful band. Self-titled debut in 2008, sophomore album in 2010, both met with praise. And then their newest album, Modern Vampires of the City, debuted at number one on the Billboard Music chart in May. They will be in Fayetteville.
Wednesday,
as part of a tour that's kicking off for fall that also includes Mexico, Norway, Scotland, France, and Australia. That should tell you something about the caliber of what you're seeing.
We're pretty lucky.
Showtime is 7:30 at the Arkansas Music Pavilion. Tickets are $36.50 in advance, $40 the day of the show at 443-5600. And Kevin gets the prize for the best headline of last week.
Okay.
Music with teeth.
That's a good one. Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. And this is Ozarks at Large, sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. The Ozark Blues Society of Northwest Arkansas's annual Blues Challenge is Wednesday, October 2nd, from 6 until 11:30 p.m. at George's Majestic Lounge in Fayetteville. For more information, go to ozarkbluessociety.org. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Fort Smith, and Elkins. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.